This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is the top 10 at 10. Is it Totsi?
Totsi.
Totsi.
Yes. Which is okay. I mean, it's obviously very, very Oscar friendly, and it has an urban, gritty feel to it. Very good soundtrack. I don't think it's quite the masterpiece that everybody thinks it is, but I think it is. It's a good and interesting film, and although it's a film about gang violence, it does have a sort of redemptive heart.
Robert Bathurst.
Yeah, it's the only film of this lot that I've seen, and I'm with Mark on this, actually. I was really quite looking forward to it. I thought it was a bit facile, the way it tugged at the emotional heartstrings, and I thought it was it didn't work and it didn't involve me as much as I hoped it might.
So of this 10, that's the only one you've seen?
Yeah. Okay, of 10, is it?
Yeah. Well, that's the top 10, so it was...
Oh, yeah.
So we went for 10.
Hear that.
Randomly.
Old-fashioned people that we are. But feel free to make caustic comments or any other comment as we go through.
Because believe me, you wouldn't be the first film critic in this country to pass judgment on a film you haven't seen.
Really? Who are you thinking of?
I'm not even going to say for legal reasons.
Big Mama's House 2 at 9.
It's worse than Big Mama's House 1.
Did you see Big Mama's House 1?
No, I didn't see that, neither.
Oh, imagine the laughs. Martin Lawrence has to dress up as a fat woman. Be still, my aching sides.
God, it's been done, hasn't it?
Yeah, in Big Mama's House. Yeah. And, of course, in that Robin Williams movie in which he does that impression of Bill Forsyth.
They always like that. I mean, real fat people, with exceptions, don't get the roles. They have to pull on the latex and they all have to say, you know, this is actually, I'm not really that fat.
Yeah, because actually it is a criminal offence in Hollywood to be overweight.
Absolutely. Lucky number 7 is at 8.
Which I like very much and like it largely because I think Paul McGuigan is a very, very fine director. I think he has real style. I think he understands music and movies, you know, terrifically. I think it's an okay script and has fine performances from its genre cast, but I think he's the star of it.
Walk the Line at... Oh, sorry, but Robert, do you
have anything to say? Yeah, pass after it till Lucky Number 8.
Walk the Line at 7, the Johnny Cash biopic.
It is wonderful. I saw it again the other day, and I mean, I can't find fault with that film. Some people have complained and said that it doesn't do the darker side, it doesn't do the thing about him crawling into the cave and having the moment of revelation. No, it doesn't. It is what it is. It is a particular story. And I think Joaquin Phoenix's version of Johnny Cash, you know, you were talking about not doing an impression but playing the role. That's what he does. And wasn't it wonderful to see Reese Witherspoon win Best Actress? Because she's just great.
I'm slightly against you on this one.
Okay, go ahead.
I just think that...
you haven't seen it?
Yeah, I have seen this one. You said Walk the Line. I wrote down the list, and Walk the Line wasn't on the list that you read out, so I thought that... that's
right.
Why I said 10.
You've got a 1982 chart.
I'd see yet another biopic where you have the inevitable rise, drink, drugs, fall, and redemption yet again. There's one moment that spoilt it for me slightly, which was when Johnny Cash had just come off stage, and the next guy on comes on, he stands in the wings and looks, and it's Elvis. Mm-hmm. And Elvis gets a bigger round than Johnny Cash did, and he looks out, and he smiles, and he nods. He isn't the performer going, just... He's taken my.
The thing
career.
About it is, it's very, very hard for anybody to do an impression of Elvis. And in fact, if I have any criticism of the film, it's that it's very hard to do Elvis, and it's the one moment that doesn't quite ring true. But what they do manage to do is to get that sense of the whole Sun shebang, that whole, you know, it was basically a jamboree on the road, and give you a sense of what it must have been like to see a bill which had Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis. I thought that stuff really worked, and it worked more for me because they were actually playing. The double bassist actually knew which end of the bull fiddle was which end of the bull fiddle, and you know, it drives me nuts seeing bands playing. You know,
yeah, me too.
But it was also produced by June Carter's son, so no wonder that part came out well. I thought
the first
wife was rather badly dealt with.
Well, yeah, she has apparently, yes, I mean, that Johnny Cash's daughter has been very upset.
However,
by that.
It did, in its favour, you have to say, it did deliver England apparently a test victory against India because they said that the thing that fired them up for the final day was going to the dressing room and listening to Ring of Fire.
Right, so I heard
which played very loudly, and they came out and they won the test match.
Fantastic.
Not that you'd know anything about the cricket.
Mark. No, but I know about curry.
Date movie at 6.
No, that was to do with Ring of Fire.
I realise what you were saying. Date movie at 6.
I decided not to do that one.
Rubbish.
Were you not offered a role in that?
No. I decided not to do the Ring of Fire gag.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was just, it's impossible not to do it.
Syriana at 5.
Well, I don't think Steve Gagan is the great white hope that everybody thinks he is. I think that the movie thinks it's much cleverer than it is. And my feeling with all these things is, yes, Steve, I know, we are all interconnected in the great global conspiracy, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But making your movie incomprehensible doesn't mean you're cleverer than us. It just means you're not a great storyteller. And if you want proof of Steve Gagan's inability to tell a story, go look at the script of Rules of Engagement. I'm sorry, it's there on paper.
Apparently, you were offered the title role in Syriana.
Syriana, to play Syriana.
By Syriana, yes.
Mr. Syriana.
Mr. Syriana. How do you do?
Chicken Little at 4, you were in that as well. Robert, of course, had a big starring role in Chicken Little.
As good of. Little or the. It's War of the Worlds meets a Disney cartoon. I don't quite understand why.
You can see Robert in The Hills Have Eyes, though.
Hills Have Eyes, tell me about it.
Well, you saw the original Hills Have Eyes, yeah?
No, tell me.
Oh, it was just terrible.
No, it wasn't. The original Hills Have Eyes is a supremely intelligent horror movie about the dark side of the civilized man. Of
a family. Hillbilly cannibles terrorizing
no,
a decent,
no, no,
fine
no, 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 absolutely
I
wrong.
Know, I'm
absolutely
provoking.
Wrong. Yes, you know, family go out into the world and discover the ego to their id or the id to their ego. In fact, the whole point about the original is these two sides of the same person. Because in the remake, you don't get any of that at all. You just get exactly what you just said. Middle class family go out and meet horrible cannibals and that's a bit yucky, but it all happened because of nuclear testing. I mean, it's directed by Alexander Ayer, who is a great director, and Switchblade Romance is one of the best Euro-Belgian horror movies of recent years, but it's not the Wes Craven film.
In V for Vendetta, it's actually Robert Barthes behind the mask. that's who that is.
And I like V for Vendetta more. I mean, I've read so many sniffy, poncy reviews of this in upmarket broadsheets. Oh, you know, oh dear, it's so silly. And it's under with two things. Firstly, Alan Moore's disowned it. Alan Moore disowns everything. He doesn't like movies. That's the beginning and end of it. Stop making a big issue about it. It is a much more anarchic film than one could expect from a mainstream movie. It's actually rather well designed. It ends on something approaching a revolutionary radical note. No, it's not a huge serious movie, but as popcorn fodder goes, it's about as subversive a popcorn movie as I've seen in some years. And I think that some of the broadsheet critics should just grow up.
And extraordinarily, The Pink Panther is the UK's number one.
And extraordinarily, I can't give you a verdict on it, because extraordinarily, they wouldn't show it to us.
Which usually means...
You have to go pay to go and see it. But I haven't actually got round to paying to go and see it.
If a movie is not shown to critics, it can't be that they've got a lot of faith.
No. I mean, basically, they made a mistake. They did show it to critics at the very beginning, like about 5-6 months ago. And the response was so bad that they decided they wouldn't show it to anybody else. Now, actually, from what anyone can tell, it's no more lousy than much of the stuff we've got shown. But of course, the thing is, as soon as you don't show a film to the critics, you just provoke anger and ire. Now, I can't pass judgment. It may be Citizen Kane. I'm going to pay to see it this weekend, and then I'm going to send the film company the ticket stub.
Someone said to me the other day that they've got some post-ironic spin on it. It's meant to be bad.
Right. Bear that in mind, Mark, when you're going to see it. Robert, before you leave us, if you heard about a if there was going to be a movie with your favourite actor and your favourite director in that you would go and see whatever anyone else said, who would be filling those names?
Gene Hackman, I think. I'd love to do something with him. My Life as a Dog is one of my favourite films ever. I'd love to do something as quirky and as interesting as that with Lasse Hallström.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, Lasse Hallström is a very good director, although when he's good, he's very good, and when he's off the boil, he is rather off the boil. But I think My Life as a Dog is a very good film. Gene Hackman is an interesting case, because the question with Gene Hackman is Gene Hackman a genius, or is Gene Hackman cast in roles in which he is allowed to be brilliant? And the key text there is French Connection. Everyone during the making of the French Connection thought that he was rubbish, and then he won the Best Actor Oscar. And to this day, the director of that movie insists that he spent the entire movie thinking it's a disaster, it's going down the toilet, he cannot do the role. And then, of course, he's brilliant.
Because everyone has probably one or two actors that they would probably go and see in anything. We've always bore people about Philip Seymour Hoffman. I've always thought he's fantastic in anything.
I've been holding a candle, as it were, for him for quite some time. He's always good. You know, Lester Bangs in Almost Famous.
Yeah, he's fantastic,
you know,
isn't
all the small roles in Talented Mr. Ripley, who just came on and inhabited it. And I've been talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and now it's become mainstream talk. But
so you better move off now.
We've supposed to be better done, yeah. But, I mean, he is somebody who is an object lesson in how to do it.
It's been good having you in, Robert. Just so, remind us, that little French play...
Yeah, I'm doing a French play at Trafalgar Studios. It's called Members Only, and it starts on Tuesday.
OK, Poirot is on ITV.
At 9 o'clock,
And also Coup.
Coup's coming out BBC sometime in June.
OK, Robert Barthes, thanks very much indeed.
Excellent.
This from Kenton, who says... I think we're back in the game, just momentarily.
OK.
Summer, fall, winter... TV, hope, chocolate, hope, red dress, hope, ecstasy, hope, cocaine, hope, heroin, hope, big jumping fridge, falling off the end of Coney Island Pier.
Oi.
No, it's not oi.
No. Well, you kept saying hope, so I imagine Shawshank Redemption. Just can do it once more, and I don't think I'm going to get it. Do it once
summer,
more.
Fall, winter, TV, hope, chocolate, hope, red dress, hope, ecstasy, hope, cocaine, hope, heroin, hope, big jumping fridge in capital letters,
big jumping
falling
fridge.
Off the end of Coney Island Pier, we've got a winner.
No.
Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Darren, not interested, really, no, I mean, yeah, actually, that is a fairly good plot synopsis. You're saying that to Sight and Sound.
No, I don't.
No.
Richard in Hove actually says, slightly different take for this. Could Mark please help me out? Name of a film that he reviewed last year. I've been longing to watch. All I remember of the review is that the film featured two women, possibly sisters, possibly French, being chased around a house by a psychopath.
Switched by romance.
Can I just finish? Yeah. And then possibly vice versa. The good doctor said it was truly terrifying, and being as all other efforts have failed, I'm now having to resort to scaring the pants off the new missus.
Switchblade Romance.
Switchblade Romance.
Originally entitled Haute Tension, directed by Alexandra Aya, who, of course, went on to direct the remake of The Hills Have Eyes that we were just discussing. And it really is something. And if you want grueling endurance Euro horror, that's the film.
No,
you don't. But it stars that woman who you interviewed, who you liked very much.
She was outrageously French.
She was outrageously
French. She was a comedy French woman.
Yes, but she's very good in that film. And she's also quite good in Around the World in 80 Days.
Matthew, on this, has just sent us a list for some reason of all the films that he avoids when he's at the video DVD shop.
Right,
he just knows
list.
That if there's a category, if there's just a type of film, a genre of film, okay, he would just not go near it. His list.
Yeah.
Films about American presidents, not relevant or interesting. Films about American sports, not relevant or interesting. Anything that features Tom Hanks, Melanie Griffiths or Meg Ryan. Any British film about plucky individuals banding together to overcome some hardship. Calendar Girls, Brass Doll, Full Monty. He puts them all in. They're all pretty good films.
I know.
So clearly, Matthew, you've just shown yourself as being sort of pretty daft, really, because there's so many good films about American presidents. Not quite so sure about American sports. Obviously, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan are fantastic. And Full Monty was great. Brass Doll was great. And Calendar Girls
And there
was
are
great.
Some good Melanie Griffith films. In fact, Fear City is a good Melanie Griffith film.
George says, classic Kermode, one of his quote, he's straight back at you, one of the best Belgian Euro horror films of recent years. Not sure how many there are, but if you can think of any other Belgian Euro horror films that could be...
Calvert.
Oh, of course, yeah, I should have thought of that.
You know.
Anyway, 85058, what are you going to talk about this week? What's new interesting?
Shall we start with Transamerica?
Well, it's your call. You're the film critic.
Okie doke. Transamerica, Golden Globe winner Felicity Huffman stars as a pre-op male transsexual forced to come to terms with fatherhood on the eve of becoming a woman. Story is, she's about to have the sex change operation when a phone call alerts her to the fact that a one-night stand that she had umpteen years ago resulted in a child who is now in prison, needs to be bailed out of prison. Her psychiatrist says you cannot have the operation until you have achieved closure on the issue of the fact that you have a son. So, posing as a Christian missionary, and bear with me because it makes a lot more sense in the film, she picks the guy up and then takes him on a cross-country
trek.
This
is her son?
Her son, but he doesn't know that she is actually his dad. Because
why are you saying she if he's a he?
Well, because it's actually politically correct to refer to somebody who is transgendered in the gender to which they aspire. So a man in drag should be referred to as a she if that is how she defines herself. Now, the kind of the key thing about the movie is Felicity Huffman's central performance. Now, for me, I had never seen an episode of Desperate Housewives, which I imagine that you've seen, right?
Yes.
So you know who Felicity Huffman
yes.
is. Okay, I didn't. I didn't know who she was, didn't know what she looked like. At the beginning of the film, you're introduced to a character looking into a mirror who looks, for all the world, like a man in drag. And I thought, call me stupid, or
no one would.
No, or say that she's doing a brilliant performance, that she really was a man in drag. She spends half the movie then being a man in drag. And of course, there is even the Mr. Happy appearance, which is prosthetic, referred to as Andy. And so there are all these, nothing at all to convince one that that's not what you're watching. I think it's a great credit to Felicity Huffman that if you didn't know who she was in advance, and of course I understand that there is almost no one in the world other than me who did not
that's
know
true.
That in advance, that's how you read the movie. The film itself is a kind of quirky little independent spirited affair that obviously was not made with a mainstream audience in mind, despite the fact that it has an Oscar-nominated song on the soundtrack by Dolly Parton, which incidentally should have won the Oscar for Best Song over that nonsensical It Sure Is Hard to Be a Pimp rubbish, which ended up winning for Hustle and Flow, and was just, I mean, outrageous, an outrageous example of terrible white middle class liberal Hollywood going, oh, we must give the award to that song because, you know, we don't really understand it, but we think it would reflect well on us. It's rubbish. That song is rubbish. The Dolly Parton song is very good. The fact that Trans America has ended up being the big sort of celebrated indie success that it is partly due to the fact that the Weinstein brothers picked it up and they do understand how to market this sort of thing. But it's partly due to the fact that it's actually quite a good movie, because during the course of their journey together, the mother stroke father and son.
But it's a father.
He is a father cross-dressing as a woman
as a
on the eve of... he's not pretending to be the mother. He's just pretending to be a woman. But he is on the eve of an operation which she is waiting to have to make her a complete woman.
And you say it's politically correct to refer to this person as her.
Yes.
Right? Because that's the direction of travel.
Yes, exactly.
So, but is it therefore politically incorrect
for Felicity Huffman to have played the role?
Have a woman. Wouldn't it make more sense to have a bloke with a little something tucked away, you know, for future reference?
Can I just say that was beautifully put? Because during the course of the movie, the change happens, it doesn't actually matter either way. And I think the really... it doesn't matter either way, because during the course of the film, the character is transgendered. So the character could be played by a man or a woman. The question is whether the character could be played as well by anybody who isn't Felicity Huffman. And I think the greatest praise of her performance is it does not matter whether in real life she is a man or a woman. Of course, now that I've seen what she looks like in real life, she's a fantastically glamorous actress. You probably saw her on stage at the Oscars and the BAFTAs. That's what she looks like. It is a great credit to her acting skills that she almost endures a physical transformation, that during the first half of the film, you believe that what you are watching is a man in drag, and during the latter part of the film, you believe that what you are watching is a transgendered woman. And you don't have, one doesn't have, a big... You just accept it for what it is. Unfortunately, I think that if you know her from Desperate Housewives, that would be slightly different. It's like, for example, watching Chiwetel Ejiofor in Kinky Boots and always being aware of what Chiwetel Ejiofor looks like normally, which is a very, very butch strapping bloke. And when you see him in drag, you are aware of the version of him that you know, but it's still a very convincing performance. The closest I can come to it is the supporting actor, lead supporting actor, Jay, can't remember his second name, from Crying Game, who I did believe was a woman.
Mayo, I think.
Ian Mayo, that's right, yes. Who I did believe was a woman until the moment of revelation, and I was as surprised as the Stephen Wright character when that... But then, clearly, I just don't notice this stuff.
Just when Robert Balthus was here, we were talking about you never have fat people playing fat people, they always have to pad up. And, again, with reference to Daniel Day-Lewis and one of his previous films, yes. By Left Foot, there was criticism
about whether or not a disabled actor...
Because surely a disabled actor should play a disabled role. I was just thinking, if you're playing... if political correctness is something that concerns you, it doesn't concern some people, it does concern others.
Sure.
If that is something that concerns you, would it not have been more politically correct to have a bloke who then goes through all those struggles to try and make himself look like a woman?
No, because during the course of the movie, the character actually crosses gender. So the character is without single gender. It is a transgendered character. And consequently, if it is played by a man or a woman, it is still, at some point, going to cross over a gender boundary. And as I said, I think the key thing in the end of this is it doesn't matter that Felicity Huffman is a woman. It matters that she is an extremely accomplished actress and an extremely physically accomplished actress and an actress whose vocal mannerisms are so impressive that you listen to it thinking, well, that's clearly a bloke doing an impression of a woman.
John in Newcastle, given the debate about if a woman should play a man becoming a woman and Mark's argument that the best person should get the role regardless of sex, why do all the major awards ceremonies insist on giving awards for best actor and best actress? They're doing the same job, acting, yet get categorised because of their sex.
Well, that, of course, was the issue, wasn't it, with Crying Game, when Jay, please tell me what his surname is, I keep wanting to say Jay Anderson, was nominated for The Crying Game in the Best Supporting Actor category, which kind of blew the gaff if you hadn't seen The Crying Game.
All right, you're done. Are you on that?
That was a perfectly sensible point.
Half a point.
Half a point.
Mark, on this, you're talking about Belgian horror.
Yeah.
Movie, Euro-Belgian horror. Now, it's clearly a much bigger
tautologist, yeah.
Rabid Grannies is the suggestion.
Yeah,
Mark,
can I just say that Rabid Grannies, the film is actually, they are neither rabid nor grannies. They're actually possessed aunties. And Rabid Grannies is a trauma retitling of a Belgian movie that in its original is not called Rabid Grannies because they're not rabid and they're not grannies.
Right. Do you have a problem also with Mark's other suggestion, forklift truck driver Klaus? You're going to tell me he's neither a forklift driver, neither is he called
Klaus?
That's
a short film and it's very, very funny and very, very gory.
Mark says, well, maybe they're Dutch, in which case the original Vanishing. Anyway, he says horror from the Low Countries.
Horror from the Low Countries, okay.
This category.
Although, that sounds like a, you know.
Just looking up Rabid Grannies. Going to grannies was never like this. They just loved their grandchildren. Well done.
But they're not grannies. They're aunties. And they're not rabid. They're possessed. I mean, I remember this. I had a big argument with Lloyd Kaufman about it when Troma put that title out.
Well, it's really worth having an argument about. You're quite right. So anyway, we don't...
You know, can I just say you're sounding even more fed up with me than usual this week?
It's not true. So Transamerica is one. What else is new?
Romance and Cigarettes. John Turturro was on the programme yesterday talking about it, although he actually does clearly find it quite hard to talk about it. He describes the movie as a down and dirty musical love story. It's an anarchic... come shambolic romp with songs and swearing designed to encompass the wide variety of human experience. On the one hand, love, aspiration, all that sort of stuff. On the other hand, the down and dirty, filthy, foul-mouthed, potty-mouthed sort of stuff. It is positively Chaucerian in its use of rude language. If you live in London and you've been on the tube, you'll notice that the posters for Romance and Cigarettes have been censored. They've got this big red square on them. I'm going to hold up the image for you. That's the poster. You know, you've seen that poster. It is a recumbent Kate
Winslet.
Nice
radio moment.
No, I'm just if people have seen the posters, if you live anywhere, you will have seen the posters, which is Kate Winslet lying on her back in a recumbent pose. The London Underground decided that picture is too rare. They've got a big red stamp on it that says, you know, if you want to see the rest of this poster, go to the such and such a website. Obviously, that's the film company playing up on the fact that the poster itself has been banned. Now, I thought the problem must be with the cigarette, because nowadays any posters involving cigarettes come under, you know, laws about advertising smoking. And certainly I agree with that. I'm militantly against smoking. And as John Turturro pointed out, this is one of the few films about smoking which demonstrates that smoking really isn't good for you.
Without giving anything away,
you think you can pretty much fill in the blanks there yourself. Of course, it turns out that they just said that the image of Kate Winslet was too brassy. Now, although I think the poster is completely innocuous, it is true that Kate Winslet's performance is jaw-dropping. You've seen the film, right?
Well, if you've seen her... I mentioned
in
this
extras,
yesterday, John,
yes.
Today. If you've seen her in Extras, it's the same kind of role.
Although Extras was done afterwards. And it is true that she went into Extras having done this.
Yeah, which you can imagine would have helped.
Yes,
so if you've seen her doing that, it's pretty much the same kind of thing, except... then some.
Yeah, and then some. And I thought that was very, very funny. There are other sort of enjoyable performances in it. Christopher Walken once again moving in that mysterious way that he did. I mean, Chris Walken dancing is just one of the strangest things on earth. He moves in a way which is just not quite right. And yet, of course, absolutely brilliant. If you saw the Fat Boy Slim video, that which he famously danced in, and of course, he always was a dancer beforehand. Abel Ferrara always used to say, oh, the thing about Chris, he can really move. And he can. He really can move. But it's just very, very odd. And his hair is particularly mad in this movie, which I approve of course, because it's real anti-gravity right up, you know, like somebody having rubbed a balloon and holding it over the top of his head. The film may be too shambolic and too anarchic for some audiences. I mean, clearly some people have just been put off by the mad switch of tones from, on the one hand, real domestic downbeat stuff, the swearing, the shouting, the kind of, you know, the domestic aggravation, and on the other hand, bursting into a redheaded woman. As you said to John Turturro yesterday, he did originally approach Bruce Springsteen to do the role, and Bruce Springsteen said he wouldn't do it because he couldn't act, although, frankly, I don't think it would have made much difference, you know.
I'm quite glad Springsteen said no.
I don't think Springsteen would say yes. I mean, Springsteen does have a cameo role in that adaptation of High Fidelity, doesn't he? There's a moment when he turns up sitting on an amplifier in a dream sequence. That's the only film I can remember seeing him in.
But rock stars, you know, I would include the sainted Elvis in this, just don't do it.
Yeah, well, David Bowie, of course, and
Sting,
and Art Garfunkel. Actually, Art Garfunkel's not bad.
Is Art Garfunkel the best, sort of, if you put him in rock and roll?
Yeah.
Is he the best singing actor?
He probably is, because, I mean, there are few
people... Elvis?
Well, I always thought Elvis would have been a great actor had Colonel Tom Parker not said to him, stop all that acting nonsense and start making a film every 3 months for $1 million.
But then
that's
Cliff?
Because... Well, actually, Cliff Richard is not a bad actor. Tommy Steele, of course, is the high watermark, because Tommy Steele was always a real song and dance man. He could act. That's where he came from. He came from that tradition in which acting and singing were both, you know, part of what he did. Anyway, back to Romance and Cigarettes.
Anyone can set the bar higher, by the way, than Art Garfunkel and Tommy Steele.
And Tommy Steele.
You know where we are.
It is a film that sort of celebrates blue-collar life. It started being written on the set of Barton Fink. And of course, you know the great gag about Barton Fink is that Barton Fink is trying to write movies about real people. And he says to John Goodman's character, I'm just writing scripts about, you know, like average working stiffs like you. And the whole point about Barton Fink is he's an idiot. But my impression of this
played
film...
Played by John Turturro.
Played by John Turturro. My impression of this film is that Turturro says that he was aiming for something that was like a script by Charles Bukowski and songs by Bruce Springsteen. I actually think that Romance and Cigarettes is the movie that Barton Fink would have written had he ever actually listened to any of those stories that John Goodman's character keeps telling him in Barton Fink, but he keeps not listening to because he's much too much of an academic to really be interested in ordinary working people. It is a blue-collar romance with all the raw edges on it, and it's raggedy and it's shambolic and it's overlong, and there are a million things that are wrong with it. But I have to say, I smiled all the way through it. I skipped out of the screening that I was in. I laughed like a drain at Kate Winslet's performance. And I thought, you know, if there are people willing to stick their neck out and make movies as outlandish as this, perhaps all is not lost.
More on this in a moment. Emails to mayo@bbc.co.uk. Don't forget there are a couple of podcasts you can sign up to based on this programme. One is Mark's movie reviews, which you can go to the Five Live website. All the details are there, and iTunes as well. And there's a Daily Mayo, which is like a half an hour, 40-minute version of what we do every day, and you could sign up for that as well. mayo@bbc.co.uk is the email, but bbc.co.uk/5live is where you go for all the podcast details. We mentioned forklift truck driver Klaus earlier in the horror Euro-Belgian category. Mark Swain in Grimsby says it's a work of utter genius.
It is.
This was recently shown at the factory I work at and had more impact than any other safety information film shown in the previous 20 years.
Is
that the kind of impact?
It's like a safety information that about the dangers that can happen to you if you don't behave safely with a forklift truck. And it's just...
Do we need telling?
It's just gore-tastic.
And in Walsall, in terms of people who can... basically singers.
Yes.
Turning up in acting... he would put George Formby.
Yeah, George Formby is a great performer. I love George Formby.
Ned Kelly, Mick Jagger?
No, I don't think Mick Jagger's that good in much other than performance.
Cher.
Ned Kelly's rubbish, actually.
It is. You're absolutely right.
Thank you.
Chris Sheeran is suggesting Cher should be in there. She's done some good stuff.
And she won an Oscar, of course, for whichever one it was.
And Mark in Ibiza is suggesting that Jack Black has got to be better than Tommy Steele. But he's an actor who can
He's an actor
sing.
Who does a bit of singing, yeah.
So that doesn't count. So I shouldn't have mentioned it. What else is new?
The Big White. This is a black comedy set amidst a blanket of white snow, and that is pretty much the whole gag. It's a Robin Williams movie. Robin Williams
Your
plays...
Your favourite.
One of those difficult characters having a very, very hard time. His wife has gone mad. She's played by Holly Hunter. You know she's mad because she wears her pyjamas and jumps around, literally jumps around swearing all the time. That's how we know she's mad. He needs some money. His brother disappeared 5 years ago. He goes to the insurance company, says, I want to take the insurance money on my brother. They say, you can't because we don't know that he's dead because there's no body being found. Guess what? Robin Williams finds a body, which he then decides to pretend is his brother. But then guess what happens? I bet you can't guess. Yes, his brother really turns up. It's one of those things that it really wants to be wacky, crazy, zany, quirky, offbeat, and all, you know, hey, oh, it's God, it's such a mad situation, you know, it's always a little bit violent, it's a little bit dark, it's a little bit like Fargo, but it's not anything like Fargo at all, really. I'm sitting there thinking, okay, there are many problems. Firstly, Robin Williams is doing one of those, feel my pain. It's like, Robin, I want you to feel my pain because I really hate you when you do these roles. Holly Hunter is usually very good in things. It's absolutely dreadful. Clearly has turned up and said, you know what I think would be great? It's if the character bounced around in her pyjamas and swore a lot, and everyone went, yeah, that's great, Holly. And then when she went, got out of the room, went, you know, really, that's not going to work. Should we tell? No, she's Holly Hunter. It's okay. She was great in Crash. Just leave her be. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is so badly directed. This is like no comic timing, no comic jouissance, no nothing at all that indicates that the man who directed it has any understanding of comedy whatsoever. And I start getting into this slightly can't breathe, panic. I start thinking of Sex Lives of the Potato Men. I start thinking about Spice World, the movie. And I'm
that good.
I can't think who the director is. Mark Mylod. And suddenly, bang! Ali G in the house, and everything falls into place. It's like, yes, of course. On TV, perfectly good director, has done a lot of stuff like Reeves and Mortimer and Shameless, all that kind of stuff. Fine. Gets into the cinema, gets behind the camera with Ali G in the house, makes one of the worst movies of all time. somehow gets allowed to be behind the camera again with The Big White, makes another of the worst movies of all time. Is currently working.
It's quite a challenge to do two.
He's currently working on The Twits, which it is alleged shall star John Cleese. And already, 2007 is looking like a great black hole in my future
Twits
comedy
is
projections.
A great story. That well, would be a shame if they messed it up.
If anyone can mess it up, that's the team for you. The Big White, laugh-free, tension-free, acting invention, everything free, directorial quality, nil, stay out of the cinema, you know, do anything you can. Clean out the cat litter rather than watch The Big White.
Singers who act, Patsy Kensit in Lethal Weapon 2, who of course was in Eighth Wonder, Search Over, says Tom Alton in Leeds.
She was in Absolute Beginners as well, wasn't she? And she was awful in that.
Alex, well, you know, is suggesting Will Smith, so...
Well, he was an actor before he was a rap star, because Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was before he became a pop star.
So he's not eligible. And this from Richard in Aylesbury, Simon, I raised the bar to Tom Waits.
Well, yes.
And Outsiders.
Yeah, actually, well, Tom Waits is great, except that he only ever plays Tom Waits. I mean, that's what he does. It's like, we'd like a gruff, trampy bloke who you can't quite understand. Is Tom busy?
Lynn in Lauderdale. I told you about your impressions. Lynn in Lauderdale, Minnesota. Barbara Streisand?
Well, I don't think Barbara Streisand can act, but I wouldn't say that in the same room as her, obviously.
Okay, well, it's looking quite intriguing for a movie of the week. But have we got... We've got to do Inside Man because of our friend Spike.
Okay, well, Inside Man, we won't play a clip because we had Spike on before, but basically it's a heist movie. Story is set in Wall Street. A group go in, take over a bank. Outside, Denzel Washington leading the police operation. Inside, Clive Owen leading the heist. Other key characters, Chiwetel Ejiofor, working with Denzel Washington. Jodie Foster having an awful lot of fun as a sort of slightly corrupt business type who's in trying to deal with the bank's own forbidden history. It is a heist movie. I think it is a character piece because it has great acting in it. I mean, Denzel Washington is really, really good. Chiwetel Ejiofor is really good. Christopher Plummer is more slimy than I have seen him in quite a long time. It also is beautifully shot. It really makes the most of that location. People have said it's Spike Lee's first genre movie. This is clearly patently not true. Clockers is a genre movie. 25th Hour, to some extent, is a genre movie. Spike Lee was executive producer on Tales from the Hood, which is absolutely a genre movie. So it's not fair to say that it's the first time...
You define genre movie?
Well, a genre movie means something like a thriller, a horror movie, a comedy, as opposed to a drama. Genre just means that it obeys certain generic conventions. And in this case, it does obey the
Euro-Belgian thriller.
Yes, I would say that is a genre.
That's a genre movie.
That is a genre, and it's a very fine genre, and I'm glad to see that it's expanding. But what Spike Lee doesn't bring to it is much of the political baggage that we expect from things like Malcolm X or Four Little Girls or Do the Right Thing. It is a much more politically light film than all of his other works. On the other hand, it does have a little bit of examination of racial tensions. It is, to some extent, a post-9/11 movie, in as much as anything that takes place in New York has that hanging over it. And, of course, Spike Lee was one of the very first people to address that in 25th Hour, which I thought was a very, very underrated movie. Of course, another great performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose presence indicates that the movie is going to be great because he's never bad in anything at all. And this is a zip-zang-boom, well-executed, nice, stylish, very well-acted thriller that, in the end, doesn't have any of the depth of Dog Day Afternoon, which is the film to which it pays homage, but it will probably have good box office response. And I think, in the end, what it is an attempt to make a hit movie so that he can then go off and make the Hurricane Katrina documentaries that he wants to make, you know, make the movies which have got more weight, more substance than this. But it's a perfectly good stopgap, and it does the job absolutely fine.
Far more interested in it than Raising the Bar, which we were doing with singers and actors.
Lowering it.
Yeah, Stephen Berkham says, I'd like to lower the bar.
Okay.
Is anyone worse than Tom Petty in The Postman, which he considers the most woeful performance of a singer doing an acting job? That's far more interesting. It's going to be far more profitable. Unfortunately, there's only 4 minutes left, and I don't think Peter and Jane will run with it as an idea.
Tom Petty, yeah, The Postman. Oh!
Which leaves us with something which looks most unedifying, unless you're a doctor of
horror
fiction. Can I just
say, the best gag about The Postman was when Q reviewed it. John Norton, this gag, copyright John Norton, he referred to it as post-apocalyptic Pat, which I thought was a lovely pun.
And also, we do need, before we lower the bar, at the top of the bar, maybe it has to be Frank Sinatra.
But he's not a... Well, is he a rock star? Okay, very quickly, because I don't want to miss this. Hostel, the latest from Eli Roth, who, of course, was the director of Cabin
Our
Fever,
friend.
Which we liked very much. Also, incidentally, served as a stand-in on Illuminata, which was John Turturro's second movie. So there we are, trivia fans. Everything is connected. The plot involves dumb backpackers, American backpackers, in Amsterdam. Somebody says to them, you know, if you want the really, really hot babe action, the place you need to go to is Slovakia. They go there. They check into a hotel that, with all the joys that they have been offered, are indeed available. Saunas, stuff. However, what they don't realise is that they are...
Is that how it's marked? Saunas over here, stuff over there.
Over here. But what they don't realise is that they are, in fact, going to be the main item on a torture menu, that, in fact, they are being led there as bait for a hostel in which people are allowed to indulge their most horrible and violent fantasies. Now, the thing about the horror genre is... The horror genre can do things like it can exploit really complicated fears, like fears of identity, fears about the loss of identity, fears about existential angst, fears about life, death, the universe, God, all the rest of it. What this does is it exploits the fear of having your toe lopped off with a bolt cutter, or somebody attacking you with a blowtorch, or being tied to... Yes. I mean, that's the fear that it exploits. And it does that...
Perfectly understandable, really.
Exactly. It does it perfectly well. It's a date movie. It's not a horror movie that's in any way upsetting the minute you leave the cinema. It's like one of those movies in which teenagers will go and see them. It's an 18 certificate, incidentally. But teenagers will go and see them, and they will, you know, they get scared and they kind of cling on to each other. And that is one of the early selling points of what horror movies were for, is that it's a way of getting close to somebody you want to get close to, be it male or female, that, you know, you huddle together in the dark and you have this kind of shocking experience. And at the end of it, you're kind of bonded. And,
you're grateful that you still got your toe.
Yeah, but there's sort of an erotic frisson to it as well. And there is. That's what the movie does. The problem with it is that I think Eli Roth is a talented filmmaker. He understands how to put images together in a way which is, you know, moving and engaging. There's a cameo by Takashi Miike, the Japanese filmmaker, who made Audition, which Eli Roth thinks is, you know, a great influence on this. But, of course, this has none of the depth of Audition. It is, in the end, a let's-see-how-much-torture-you-can-endure movie with no substance whatsoever. It's a popcorn and vomit film, and that's perfectly fine. I have no problem
with that.
Is that a genre? I've just made it up, and yes, it is. And I imagine that we'll get more examples of it. But I think that Eli Roth needs to do something a lot more substantial than this if he's going to prove that there is something more to him than simply a schlock maestro.
Can we hear a bit?
Because I think there's really no point, because basically, I'll do the clip for you. Here's the clip.
Oh, great.
Because,
no, so this is...
For the podcasters...
Are terrible. Your acting is
for
worse.
The podcasters amongst you,
they
because they
that.
Never... No, they never get to hear the clip, but it's okay, because from a copyright issue, I can do it. This is what the clip went. No! No! That's it. And then it goes on like that for
so
a little bit more.
What is happening?
The man is discovering the joys of the bolt cutter. It's basically... it's a dumb teenage endurance test, somewhat shackled by the 18 certificate, although I understand why it got that certificate, because, you know, it is pretty tough. But don't take any of it seriously. If you want a movie that'll just make you shriek and, you know, cringe, there is one moment in it in which I did go, oh, yuck. But the rest of the audience that I was with were cowering and heads in the seat bag.
What we need to do in future for the podcast is, you know, we just need to reenact the clip, so then there's no copyright problem. We can just...
Exactly.
Play various roles. Is that a daft idea?
That's fine.
Movie of the week?
Well, I would say Romance and Cigarettes, actually.
Thank you for your company, Mark.
Thank you. Did you enjoy it?
I did. Back tomorrow. No, we're not. It's the weekend. I don't think I'll come in. Let's try Monday at 1. Drive is next on AM, on digital and online. You're listening to 5 Live.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.